Good morning. May it please the court, my name is David Woolley.
Wait till we get everybody out of the courtroom.
I'm so sorry.
Okay. Good morning.
May it please the court, my name is David Woolley. I represent Paul Burke. This is a highly fact-specific case that should have gone to the jury and should not have been decided on summary judgment. Paul Burke was injured in what everyone agrees was an opportunistic ambush in Afghanistan. The court ruled that he assumed the risk of his injuries. Assumption of the risk requires knowledge of whatever the particular risk is, and it is impossible to have knowledge of an opportunistic ambush.
Well, it's possible to know that you're entering a situation in which it's impossible to know what the risk is, isn't it?
It is possible.
And you can voluntarily enter into a situation where you know that you're not going to know the nature of the risks.
It is possible, but in this case, the facts were not given to Mr. Burke, and the court did not examine those facts. The facts that were not given to Mr. Burke, which were relevant to the risk and relevant to his knowledge, were that he was being sent on what was a secret mission when he thought it was a routine mission. He was not told that he was going in cold. He was not told that Mr. Chase of LBG had decided not to get ground information, and there was ground information.
Were his 10 previous ambushes situations where he knew he was going into secret missions?
No, he wasn't. There were 10 previous flights on this helicopter.
How many previous ambushes?
Right.
And in each of them, were they all, did he know that they were secret missions?
No. And they weren't. Many of them were cases where Mr. Chase had told him, this is a dangerous situation, be careful. And they were also not involved in the schools and clinics.
So the problem was he didn't know to be careful?
Pardon?
So is the problem that he didn't know to be careful?
Oh, no, he knew to be careful. He was careful. He didn't know the degree of risk and the new element point. And assume one goes takes the MTA to work, and you get jounced around and jostled and banged around in a subway car. Subway cars don't have seatbelts. Suddenly, the subway is in a very serious collision. People are injured, and the subway company, the MTA, decides that we're going to defend on the grounds that you knew we didn't have seatbelts. You knew there was a risk. The point is the degree of risk, the incredible force involved. In the district, that's the Novak and the Sinai cases, where the court has said new elements come into effect. The new element in the Novak and Sinai cases were a fight and someone pulled a gun, or there was a fight and someone was hit by a plank. Here, Mr. Burke went on a routine mission. He was circumspect.
Is there any mission in Afghanistan that's routine?
Well, remember in 2006 when this happened, Afghanistan was a more peaceful place than it actually is today. There were routine missions, and if you look at Appendix 398, that is the statement of LBG itself reporting to members of LBG that this was a routine mission to examine a schools and clinics facility. Mr. Burke thought it was a routine mission. He says so. He was led to believe it was a routine mission. He was not told that Badgis, the local contractor, was in the process of being fired by LBG, that Badgis, the local contractor, was in the process of being stiffed for $20,000 in his fee by LBG. He wasn't told that there had been no ground report as to the conditions in the village.
Do we know the identity of the attackers?
No.
So how do you know it has anything at all to do with any of those acts?
We do not know who the attacker was. It's unlikely to have been Taliban because the Afghani interpreter was unscathed. And if it was Taliban, they'd have killed
him. Maybe they were bad shots.
Lots of speculation. But isn't that the point?
Why? No, that is exactly what we say we don't give to juries, is speculation.
Speculation to juries, you're correct, Your Honor. But you do give inferences of fact to juries. And the inferences of fact are quite clearly that there
On what basis could they infer that the shooters were people who were upset by the acts of this person's employer rather than Taliban taking an opportunistic opportunity to kill Westerners?
The argument we would make to the jury is that...
What's the evidence that you would present?
The evidence is that they went in cold, and they weren't attacked as they went in. They were attacked on the way out. They had not delivered...
Taliban doesn't like to attack on the way out?
No, the Taliban likes to attack Afghanis rather than Americans first because they're
the... Do you have expert testimony on that?
Mr. Burke, I think, would be able to testify.
Did he proffer that?
Pardon?
Did he proffer that testimony?
No, he did not. He would.
As long as we're on the expert testimony question, what do we do with the... assume just as we begin this discussion that you do need expert testimony. Well, what do you do? You don't have any.
Yes. I will accept the court's assumption now, though I would like to address the assumption later. There is a thing called a hybrid law fact expert, particularly in this district. I think Mr. Burke would qualify as a hybrid law and fact.
But he didn't offer himself. He didn't offer himself that way. That's the problem.
We didn't, and you're quite right.
So what other argument? How could this have been resolved without expert testimony? You have a big argument that this does not require expert testimony.
But without assuming that.
Let me just ask: Is your argument really based on the movies that people have seen and the television? Because I have to say, that's a little confusing to me.
My argument as to whether the jury could take the reasonable man standard is that it is not a particularly difficult thing for a jury to assess whether you have been sent into danger irresponsibly, unreasonably, with insufficient information. That is not a difficult thing for a jury to undertake.
But the movies that you talk about, Gunsmoke, Outlaw Josie Wales, Lonesome Dove, in each one, there's an ambush.
That's correct.
Yeah. So maybe what a jury should take from that is that good guys always walk in ambushes. I mean, I don't see what lesson you could take from these other than the fact that in every movie, the good guy gets ambushed. So he ought to be careful.
And in that respect, my client is one of the good guys who got ambushed.
Right. So then he assumed the risk. He's a good guy. He knows good guys are going to be ambushed. He has a choice. He either takes this job or he doesn't.
That's exactly the case, too. Yes, he takes this job or he doesn't. The question is not whether he takes the job, whether or not he's ambushed. The question is whether he was given sufficient information to know where the ambush was likely to occur, how to avoid it, how to get around the facts.
Tell me what you think High Noon tells us about this. There's no ambush in High Noon. Instead, in High Noon, Gary Cooper knowingly goes to meet the Miller gang. And he does so even after he tries to get the townspeople who are cowardly, and they don't go with him. He goes anyway. Now, is that assumption of the risk?
Yeah.
Seems like it.
Absolutely, but in Gary Cooper's case, it's not assumption of the risk because his employer required him to take that risk. And in this district, you do not have assumption of the risk for employer
requirement. Well, my recollection is he voluntarily took his star and put it back on. This was not a question of being required by the Marshal Service. His representatives are probably still in this courtroom. So I just don't understand what you think the jury is going to get out of this movie.
Oh, the jury's got out of that movie. I wouldn't have used it, Your Honor.
You did use it.
High Noon? I don't think so.
My list comes from your brief.
Oh, damn. I didn't think I'd used High Noon. What I was trying to argue with in the Western scenario wasn't that there's a particular movie that is exactly on point. The Stagecoach might be. My argument was
I don't think John Wayne sued anybody at the end, though.
That's the thing. Those are the old days. You can nowadays. The point was that the jury is capable of understanding what a reasonable man might do and what kind of risks a reasonable man might face. It's not a matter for an expert, it seems to me. But may I talk about the fact that we don't need an expert or the district rule is not the rule that should be applied here. And were the case to be remanded to Judge Kennedy for trial, and I would very much like that to be the case, we would certainly make a motion to Judge Kennedy to nominate an expert, and I'm sure
he's already rejected that, though. You tried to do that late, isn't that right?
We asked for permission to nominate an expert as part of our briefing, And Judge Kennedy said, no, it's too late to do so, though at no time in this case has there been a trial date set. And when you look at the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, the dates for those procedures are dated 90 days or 60 days from trial. So there was clearly time and the ability to nominate an expert. Briefly, very briefly, on the municipal rule that you must have an expert. First, it is not outcome determinative. The rule says you shall have an expert. If you have an expert, the jury decides. Therefore, the expert rule is not outcome determinative because the outcome is determined up or down by the jury.
Well, but what outcome, the Supreme Court's opinion say outcome determinative is not exactly the best way to describe this, right? Whether it makes it more difficult to bring your case in one court over rather than another in such a way that it might affect your choice of forum. A general matter, it's clear, and certainly clear from our own cases, that it's more difficult to come up with, unless your view is, and I assume it's not, that an expert can be paid to say anything. It must be harder to have an expert, or an expert is required to find an expert who will say what you need, and maybe that you won't be able to find one. So in a particular case, maybe in your case, you can honestly find one, but we're not making it eerie. It doesn't allow us to make a judgment about your particular case, right? You want to throw out the rule altogether. You're not saying that it doesn't apply just in your case.
Correct. I'm saying the rule does not apply in federal court.
Right. So in that case, we have to look at the entire spectrum. And looking at the entire spectrum, there will certainly be cases where somebody has brought a case that he can't find an expert to support.
Right.
And that would be outcome determinative in any sense.
It will be outcome determinative at the close of plaintiff's case.
Well, it will be outcome determinative at the beginning. That is, if you know that if you go into the Superior Court of the District of Columbia, you need an expert, but you don't have one. And if you go into the federal court, you don't need an expert and you don't have one. You are going to choose the federal court before the case begins, not after the case, before.
Yes and no. This is a diversity case in Afghanistan. I wouldn't be suing in the Superior Court of District of Columbia, period. I wouldn't be suing there. This is only a federal case. It is a diversity case brought because
brought in any state court.
This case, I don't think you'd bring it. I don't think any lawyer in his right mind would bring it in the Superior Court.
That's a different question. Can you bring it?
Can I bring
it? Your view that you couldn't have brought this in the District of Columbia? This would present perhaps the most interesting federal jurisdiction question I've had in a long time, which is, can you bring in a diversity case in federal court a case that you cannot bring in any state court? I don't think you can.
I agree with you. Back to the rule of evidence. Rule 702, I think, trumps the local municipal rule. Rule 702 gives the district court the discretionary right to require an expert. And that's the whole point. It's a discretionary permissive right at the close of trial. If the court believes there has been insufficient proof given to the jury as to the standard of care or whatever else is required to justify the plaintiff's case, the court can then take the case away from the plaintiff. But he can't do so beforehand. Rule 702 doesn't give him that permission. Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Mr. Zeleny.
May it please the court, Frank Zeleny representing the appellees. I won't take up too much of the court's time. I listened to Judge Garland's questions, and they pretty much preempted the arguments I was going to make on assumption of the risk.
They're only questions, though, not arguments.
I understand, Your Honor. But the point being that the risk that was assumed here with respect to ambush is that there was an opportunistic threat of an ambush regardless of where the location, regardless of the cause. The appellants are trying to make a claim that there was some sort of a secret mission and that somehow increased the risk. The fact is, just as Your Honor asked, that no one knows the source of the attackers, who they were, why they were attacking, and there's absolutely no evidence. Discovery is closed. There's absolutely no evidence that this is somehow related to a financial dispute, and I think that that is an enormous reach and would require clear speculation on the part of the jurors. So from that standpoint,
how about this? If they had advised the people they were going to visit that they were coming, couldn't the locals have said, we've noticed a lot of Taliban around? Or, I mean, that's what concerns me about this, keeping it secret. I mean, Burke not knowing that they're going in without the local people knowing and the local people's input about what's going on the ground.
Well, Your Honor, there's no evidence that that increased the risk. In fact, it was the position of the person at Louis Berger who testified that the reason he didn't tell them in advance, or that there was, he didn't say it was the reason he didn't tell them in advance, but that by letting people know in advance, it might be increasing the risk by allowing that information to escape and to let them know that there are people that are going to be arriving, that an ambush. The point being, that issue alone would require expert testimony.
Yeah, I would agree with you, except I thought this LBG fellow said, we don't want them to know we're coming because we want to check up on them, and we want to surprise them, we want to see if they're loafing, we want to see what they're doing.
Well, that's true, Your Honor, but the point being, that issue aside, there is a reasonable grounds for people to argue that it's not necessarily a better approach to let people know that you're coming from a security standpoint. Not only that, but Paul Burke, and all of the evidence we put in the record was from Paul Burke's testimony. He knew the route of flight. He knew where they were going. He had access to all of the hot spots. He had access to Army intelligence. He had access to the United Nations database. What the argument that Mr. Woolley is making here is that the contractor who hired the security company should be warning the security company of risks that are out in the field. The fact is that Paul Burke, having been through many ambushes, both before and after this incident, knew that there was a risk of ambush. The cause of that risk is really irrelevant to the determination. The risk never changed. The risk was always a risk of ambush. He said he had been in lots of ambushes before this ambush. After he recovered from his injuries, he went back to Afghanistan and was involved in yet another ambush in another unarmed vehicle. And so he fully understood. In addition, he understood the specific risks of landing in this place at that time, which is why he had the helicopter circle the landing site, look for threats, land the helicopter, advise everybody on board not to remain on the ground for more than 10 minutes, and he patrolled. Although he said he wasn't providing security, and that's immaterial to the issue, he did no business on the ground other than to patrol with his AK-47 rifle and his MP5 automatic pistol. And then he got everybody back on the helicopter because he knew there was a threat, what he described as an opportunistic threat. In other words, it can arise anywhere that someone has the opportunity to attack. So the cause, whether it had to do with financial difficulties or whether it had to do with Taliban, it doesn't matter. The fact is, it was a dangerous place. The risk of ambush was something that he knew about, and he accepted plainly. And he was more sophisticated.
Can you clarify for me just for a minute, who the defendants in this case are?
I'm sorry?
Who are the defendants?
The defendants are AirServe Helicopters, which is a helicopter company, and Louis Berger Group, which is a construction company. And I think it's important, if it isn't clear in the papers.
He didn't sue his own employer, I take it.
I'm sorry?
He did not sue his own employer?
He did not. He could not. There is something called a Defense Base Act. It's akin to it's akin to workers' comp.
Uh-huh.
And
who, the allegation about who should have told him about the secret mission is that Berger Group should have told him?
Yes.
And not his own employer. Does his own employer know?
Well, his own employer knew that they were taking the trip. That was reported by Paul Burke to his employer. His employer had a military liaison on their staff for just this purpose. And I think it's important to understand the lineup here. Louis Berger was doing contracting work in Afghanistan for USAID. They needed transportation, so they hired a helicopter company. They needed security, so they hired USPI. Paul Burke gave up his relatively safer job at the United Nations as security officer to take a riskier job, an armed job, at USPI, which was providing security for Louis Berger and the helicopter company.
What about Mr. Burke's complaint that he couldn't possibly have anticipated that the emergency beacon would only warn somebody in New Guinea? Yeah.
That's a real red herring, Your Honor. The fact is that the undisputed testimony of Paul Burke and his interpreter who was with him is that they were wounded almost instantly, that the firing was over in a half an hour. Paul Burke was equipped with a satellite telephone by which, given the time, he would have been able to make a phone call. This whole issue of radios and communication. The fact is the firing, by their own admission, was over within a half hour. The party that would be contacted immediately in the event of an emergency was USPI. And USPI, the help did not arrive until 1 hour after USPI got the information. That's undisputed testimony of Paul Burke and his interpreter. So that even if they had the ability to transmit the warning instantly by mental telepathy or whatever, it took them an hour to arrive after the alarm reached the party who was supposed to get the alarm. And by that time, all of the firing was over. So we don't get into the factual details of whether the radios were working or not, all of which we dispute. The fact is, help couldn't have gotten there in time regardless. So that's just a red herring. Not only that, but the issue of radios, beacon, and so on and so forth. I went in a question. It was a question that was a once-in-a-lifetime lawyer question when I said to Paul Burke in his deposition, so what you're saying is that you knew, and I listed all of the complaints that he had about the helicopter, and I said, it was your belief that all of these deficiencies existed. His response was, I didn't believe it. I knew it. And it was about as clear as an assumption of the risk as I have ever come across. Let me just shift very quickly to the expert witness issue. The only argument that I want to just make add a point that's not in our brief is relating to whether or not Paul Burke could act as his own expert. Number one, there was no information proffered that he was qualified on each of the areas where an expert would be required, and there are many. As a matter of fact, the plaintiff appellant listed a whole group in their brief. He's certainly not qualified on all those issues. Number two, more importantly, he was never designated as an expert, and even a plaintiff must be designated as a non-retained expert under Rule 26 if they're going to testify on any subject matter under Rule 702, 703, or 705 of the Federal Rules of Evidence. So if I have a minute left. If there's any questions, I'm going to stop unless the court has a question for me.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Woolley, have any time now? All right, why don't you take a minute?
Thank you, Your Honor. Garland asked about the employer situation. He was sent directly by Mr. Chase of LBG, bypassing his normal employer, which is one of the reasons we're pointing to Mr. Chase not giving him the information that he needed. It is perfectly correct that there are ambush risks. But if Mr. Chase knows I'm not paying these people, I'm stiffing them for their fee, I haven't got the normal precautionary report from the ground, which is normal, he should have said that to Mr. Burke. So Mr. Burke could judge the degree of risk.
Again, who is it he was stiffing for the fee?
Mr. Chase, LBG, was stiffing Badghis, the local Afghani contractor.
Uh-huh.
And he was the schools and clinic operator there. He was the builder. They were trying to get rid of him, and they were also stiffing him for his fee at the same time.
I take it there's not any evidence that Badghis was a shooter or anybody working for Badghis.
There's no direct evidence of that whatsoever. It's a reasonable inference from the fact. The emergency locator beacon point is important for several reasons, one of which it shows just how incredibly amateurish this helicopter operation was. But more importantly, if there had been a direct two-way communication system, as they were being shot, the pilot could have said, help, we're being shot. Nothing happened. because he couldn't do that. They fell out of the helicopter. Burke was shot three times as he was falling out of the helicopter.
What about the opposing counsel's point that it was too late, but by the, even if he could have instantaneously called, we're being shot, Burke was already shot. Burke was already shot.
Burke was partially already shot. He got yet more shots when he was out of the helicopter. Sometime after he fell out of the helicopter and was sheltering by the skids, he was shot in the knee, which
nearly... What's the longest estimated time from the first shots to the last shots? Is there any evidence in the record about that?
None that you can say this is...
Was it more than an hour?
No.
So the
shooting had ended by the time the U.S. cavalry arrived.
Or could have arrived.
No. Mr. Burke shot 7 magazines of an AK-47 and 5 magazines
of a Browning
high power.
I'm not worried about all the shooting. I'm worried about the shooting in which he himself was injured. That's the only thing he can complain about. So in the shooting on him...
He can complain about the pain and suffering as a result of it.
Yes, of course. But as a result of the shooting. So was there enough time between the first shot and the last shot that hit him for the cavalry to have arrived?
Almost certainly not.
So then what's...
10 minutes one would expect, or 15, but one cannot say for certain. Okay. We do know that he was shot very shortly once the shooting started. He then fell out of the aircraft, sheltered by the skid. He was shot in the leg and groin. The pilot then stood up to press the emergency locator beacon that sounded in Papua New Guinea and was shot dead through the head. Thereafter, he struggled.
Was he in the pilot in the helicopter?
They'd fallen out underneath the right skid. He then struggled to a ditch and continued firing back. So we cannot say the time.
This could be a movie by itself, by the way. This whole thing could be a movie by itself.
It's just an astonishing story.
Black Hawk Down. There you go.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I have 30 seconds.
All right.
I apologize, but I just wanted to clear two things. Number one, Paul Burke has taken the position in this case that he was not under contract to provide security, which means Fred Chase had no authority to order him to do anything. He didn't work for Fred Chase, and he wasn't under contract to Fred Chase, so he had no obligation to do anything. Secondly, appellant's brief, page 10, says firing lasted roughly 30 minutes.